You may be seated. Our next case is 13-761 Cleo Renfro versus North Fork Southern Railroad Company. Mr. Podhizer.
Thank you, Your Honor. Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Ira Podhizer. I represent the appellant Norfolk Southern Railway Company. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. This case involves construction of the Ohio Asbestos Statute, HB 292. The issue involved here is pretty straightforward. Whether the 8th District correctly permitted the introduction of an exception to the competent medical authority requirement contained in the statute. The 8th District's VA exception has the effect of, in our view, of eviscerating the competent medical authority requirement and allows courts to consider the reports of paid private experts who didn't treat the plaintiff.
Let me get you there on that, because that's where I'm confused about your appeal here. Are you saying that Dr. Rao is not competent?
He is not under the terms of the statute, yes, Your Honor.
Not competent?
Yes.
Why?
Because he didn't treat the plaintiff, Mr. Renfro.
And is that what you're asking us to say today, that an expert in asbestos must be a treating physician to be competent?
Yes, because that's what the statute says, Your Honor.
So you're not questioning his competency?
At this point, no. As a B reader, I'm not questioning necessarily his competency. I'm questioning that under the strict requirements of the statute, he has to be a treating physician.
Thank you.
And I don't think there's any doubt that he is not. I don't think there can be any dispute. This court, I believe, must reverse the 8th District because the 8th District essentially ignored and rewrote the statute to include an exception which is not contained in the express language. Now, that's something that you alluded to, Justice O'Neill. I think without this exception, I think all of us could agree that this case would have had to have been administratively dismissed. Number one, there's no dispute that Mr. Renfro was a smoker under the terms of the statute. That meant that the prima facie evidence requirements were triggered, which also meant that he needed the opinion of a competent medical authority, someone who treated him for his lung cancer, in order to meet the prima facie requirements. Second, there is no medical evidence whatsoever in the record of asbestos exposure, nothing.
Counsel, I want to stay on that last question then. Are you referring to 230792C1?
I believe so, yes.
And you're saying that is a requirement that it be a treating physician?
Yes.
I'm reading the statute. I don't see the word treating physician in it.
I could find it, Your Honor, but I believe it says that there has to have been some type of doctor-patient relationship between the doctor and the plaintiff.
And I want to understand your argument so that, for example, if somebody presents to a doctor in Chagrin Falls and say, examine me for the purpose of litigation, is that a relationship?
I would say for purposes of the statute, no. And the reason why is because there's other requirements in there that have to be met. Well, for example, I think one of the requirements is that no more than 25% of his practice has to be devoted to being a consulting expert. I'm paraphrasing the statute.
I understand. Right. We've all lived through that. I understand.
Right. So I think going back to what I was saying, that I don't think there's any doubt that if without this VA exception, there would be no dispute here, and that the case would have had to have been administratively dismissed. There is no competent medical authority opinion. There's no evidence of asbestos exposure, medical evidence of asbestos exposure.
Right, there's no evidence of asbestos exposure or no medical evidence?
There's no medical evidence.
Okay, because he had a coworker, right?
Correct.
And the coworker talked about handling the raw asbestos and, you know, all that stuff, right?
Right. But that's not medical evidence, Your
Honor.
Okay,
so let's say, when you say there's no evidence, let's be specific.
You're right, Your Honor. What happened here, beginning with the 8th District's opinion in Senate, is that the 8th District introduced an exception, which I'll colloquially refer to as the VA exception, to the competent medical authority requirement. And basically, what this exception says, according to the 8th District, is that because of the what they term as the unique nature of the relationship of the treating regimen at a VA facility, you cannot establish a traditional, and those were the words that the court used, doctor-patient relationship.
That's because the revolving nature of the treatment.
Correct, Your Honor. That's the rationale.
Yes. Okay.
There's at least two things wrong with that analysis. Number one, there's nothing in the statute itself that provides for this exception. I don't think there can be any really real dispute about that, and it was something that was alluded to at the prior argument by the court here, and that it is not up to the courts to rewrite the statutes that are enacted by the General Assembly.
Counsel, the 8th District referred to two cases, Sinnott and Wipke,
yes,
and said that it is following those two cases. Were either of those cases appealed to us?
I believe Sinnott was appealed to this court, and I think the court denied jurisdiction. They didn't accept the case for review. I'm not 100% sure about Wipke.
And were there any other district courts of appeals that have taken this position?
To my knowledge, the 8th District, Justice Landsberger, is the only one that has adopted this exception to the competent medical authority requirement.
Mr. Podhizer, how are the VA cases handled in other jurisdictions?
Your Honor, quite frankly, I don't know. I don't have any information as to that.
Thank you.
As Justice Landsberger said, though, I don't know that any other appellate court in Ohio has adopted this view.
Well, that's largely because most of the asbestos cases, 40,000 or so, are venued in Cuyahoga County. That's
right.
Where they are. They're not
right
around the rest of the state.
Yeah,
so it's only likely that the 8th District would be the appellate court that would review those cases.
Right. And that's a fair observation, I think, Your Honor. I think, though, the whole idea of this round-robin approach that's been alluded to in the 8th District's jurisprudence doesn't hold up. As I said, I think the main argument here is that it's simply not contained in the statute. But number two, I just think that on its own, the whole analysis doesn't hold water. The idea behind Sinnott is that you can't identify a specific treating physician due to this round-robin nature of treatment. And that flies in the face, I think, of logic and common sense. But also, this court in other contexts has said that's just not the case. We cited to the Loewenberg case in our brief, and I believe Amicus cited to that as well. And it basically says that if a doctor treats a patient, that establishes a doctor-patient relationship. And I think
So instead of being limited, actually, you had an expansive pool of doctors for which to put forth.
Potentially, yes, Your Honor. I think potentially there could be one. There could be more than one. They identified one. The medical records refer to Dr. Lynch as the primary care physician. And not only that, but plaintiffs themselves actually sought the opinion of Dr. Lynch in order to get over the prima facie barrier. And that leads me into addressing an argument that was made by plaintiffs to the court here about the VA regulations, which purportedly prohibit doctors at the VA from giving opinions or expert evidence in litigation between private litigants. Number one, I think it's very important to note that there was a procedure in place to do this, but plaintiffs didn't go all the way. They were denied by the office, I believe it was in Indianapolis. They had a right to appeal. They didn't appeal that. Now, I know counsel will say, well, it's such a high standard, maybe it would have been futile, but the fact is that they didn't do as they were entitled to do and take an appeal. And I think it's telling as to why they didn't do it. I think that assuming Dr. Lynch was available and could give any type of opinion in this case, the first thing he would have looked at would have been the medical records. And I think he would have looked at the medical records. I don't think this is an unfair assumption here. And he would have said, well, look, the only thing that we really have here is that this fellow was a smoker for 50 plus years, a pack and a half a day. He smoked even a year before his death. So there's no evidence of asbestos exposure. There's evidence of smoking. And I think he could have said, and maybe would have said, look, I can't help you here.
But that's speculation on your part.
It is speculation.
Let's just make this hypothetical. Let's say they had appealed and the appeal was denied. Would that matter? Would that change your argument at all? Wouldn't you still be arguing it's still not good enough because there is no exception?
It's still not good enough, Your Honor, because as I said before, number one, it's just not in the statute. It's just not there. If there is a perceived unfairness here, as was alluded to in the prior argument before this one, by the court, then that is for the legislature to address. It's not for the courts to address that.
But isn't it fair to say that Judge Hanna does these cases all day long in Cuyahoga County, right?
Yes. I believe he handles the railroad cases. I think Judge Spellacy handles the other cases.
And isn't it fair to say that they've looked at the statute and they've said that in veteran cases, they simply don't have a treating physician? Isn't that fair for that judge then to say that complies with the statute?
I would say
for veterans only.
I would say no, Your Honor.
Why?
Simply because the statute does not provide for it. The express language of the statute does not provide for it. And in addition, I would say that there is a treating physician here. Now, for whatever reason, he couldn't get one, but there was one. There was I don't think plaintiffs could deny that Dr. Lynch was someone who at least ostensibly may have been able to give an opinion one way or the other, but for whatever reasons, he was not permitted to give.
So you're asking us this morning, I presume, to strike down the veterans exception that's being followed by the Asbestos Court in Cuyahoga and the 8th District Court of Appeals.
That's correct, Your Honor.
That's why you're here today.
That is why I'm here today. The other issue in my remaining time before rebuttal goes to the opinion of Dr. Rao, who, as we went back and forth before, is not in our view, a competent medical authority. I know the 8th District in the Renfro opinion did refer to him as a competent medical authority. I think they used those exact words. In other cases, I believe Link and one or two more, the 8th District said that he wasn't because he didn't treat. I mean, Dr. Rao is used all the time. I mean, the fact of the matter is maybe he may be competent as a beer reader, he may be knowledgeable in his field, but that does not make him a competent medical authority. So in our view, the case should have ended right there. However, one thing, the additional step that the Renfro panel took that I find disturbing and was a big impetus for this appeal is the way they watered down the substantial contributing factor requirement contained in the statute. Dr. Rao's opinion stated that asbestos, along with tobacco consumption, along with deleterious substances such as diesel fumes, in part contributed to his lung cancer. That is not sufficient, in our view, under the statute. This court said in Atkinson several years ago that it is essentially a but-for test. And but-for means that but-for his exposure to asbestos, his occupational exposure to asbestos, he would not have contracted lung cancer.
Where do we get the so-called VA exception? Where does that language come from?
They don't use that word. That's probably, Your Honor, more accurately, a term of art that probably we have given it in the course of this litigation. But I think it's pretty fair to say that.
Is it common in asbestos circles that we talk about this?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I have, quite frankly, I don't know if that term has been employed. It certainly hasn't been employed outside the 8th District for the reasons that you noted before. I don't know that it's been accepted or adopted in any other courts. I think probably maybe a more accurate term for that may be the non-traditional plaintiff. I think that was another term that the 8th District used in Sinnott and Wipke and this case. And Wipke, I believe, extended this exception to union members. Basically, any category of plaintiff who, for whatever reason, doesn't establish this traditional doctor-patient relationship.
Okay, thank you.
So, counsel, there's a paragraph 27 of the appellate opinion references Dr. Rao's opinion of the causal link between his occupational exposure to asbestos dust, diesel fumes, exhaust, and his developing lung cancer. And he opines that there was a synergy created here as a result of the cigarette smoking and the asbestos exposure that increased the risk of developing lung cancer beyond what would have been expected from only smoking or being exposed to asbestos dust.
Right. That's what I believe that's the 8th District's characterization of it.
Yes.
I don't think that's what the report necessarily said.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. This synergy that, or synergistically created, increased to the risk. Is that a known medical determination that if you're going to both smoke a pack and a half a day for 50 years and you're going to be exposed to asbestos for part of that time, you're going to increase your risk, or and is it any worse than only doing one or the other?
If I understand your question in terms of the synergy, is that, I think, what you're focusing on?
That's what they're using, acted synergistically.
I don't think, I'll do my best to answer your question, I don't think that's necessarily a medical term. I don't think, number one, I don't even think that was necessarily used in Dr. Rao's opinion.
This is pretty much an extrapolation by the 8th District?
I think that's a fair characterization, Your Honor. I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Torsello?
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. May it please the court. I want to start by answering your question, Chief Justice. The synergistic effect between asbestos and smoking is well established. It was established in 1979 by a doctor called Selikoff at Mount Sinai University, who did a study with another gentleman called Mr. Hammond. Anybody can go look it up. It's a well-known fact that if you're exposed to asbestos, you have about a 5 times chance greater of getting lung cancer than a regular person. If you smoke cigarettes, you have about a 15% greater than anyone else chance of getting cancer. But if you do the two things together, you have about a 90% chance.
Well, doesn't that depend on how much
cancer
you do of each?
I believe it does, Your Honor. And I believe the more you smoke and the more you are exposed to asbestos.
Well, pack and a half a day for 50 years is right up there.
Yes, ma'am. And that it goes up, it multiplies. It's a multiplicative effect, and that is a well-known medical fact. The 8th District wasn't making it up. Dr. Rao wasn't making it up. I want to come back and talk first about what this appeal is really about. It's about the substantive rights of the widow of a United States Air Force veteran to move forward with her claim. She has important rights under the Ohio Constitution. She has a right to an open court and a right to a remedy, a meaningful remedy at a meaningful time.
Counsel, can we address those questions properly? Was there a cross appeal for the constitutional questions?
Yes, ma'am. I believe you can address this question. This is the Supreme Court of Ohio, and I believe here the constitutional issues are always on the table.
Is that just based on our inherent authority, or should we require a cross appeal?
I don't believe that you should, Your Honor, and I don't believe your court rules provide for that. I think your court rule 16 provides that the appellee's brief may, and I have the exact language somewhere in here, but I can tell you that it provides that the appellee's brief shall answer the contentions of the appellant as well as raise any other grounds for affirmance of the lower court decision.
Were the constitutional questions raised below?
The constitutional question with respect to the FELA was certainly raised in the trial court. It was certainly raised at the 8th District. Neither court commented on those issues, but they were raised in both.
How about the right to remedy in open courts?
The right to remedy in open court is raised for the first time in this court. Okay. And I believe, as I said, that under Rule 16, it's always on the table here in this court.
Thank you.
What's the denial? What's the denial of the right to remedy here? The fact that the requirement for a medical expert is such as it is in the statute?
Your Honor, the definition of prima facie case and the definition of competent medical authority has made it impossible for Mrs. Renfro to comply with the language of this statute.
Why couldn't Dr. Lynch have been utilized?
If we could have spoken to Dr. Lynch, perhaps he could have. Perhaps he couldn't have. When we spoke to Mrs. Renfro, we interviewed her. She could not list one treating doctor that her husband had during his time at the VA.
The medical records would have had that information.
Yes, ma'am, they did. And those medical records contained hundreds of doctors, medical students, nurse practitioners, physician's assistants throughout those medical records. There were literally hundreds of doctors throughout.
Did you contact any of those names?
First of all, we identified Dr. Lynch because, as Mr. Potheiser noted, there was a record that said that had PCP next to his name. So our first thought would be to contact Dr. Lynch. So we called up Dr. Lynch and tried to talk to him. They referred me to the Office of Regional Counsel in Indianapolis, Indiana, whom I sent her a letter. I spoke to her on the phone. I asked her if we could talk to Dr. Lynch, first of all. At this point, and I should go back, we don't even know if Dr. Lynch meets the requirements of competent medical authority. And those requirements are extensive. It's not just a treating physician that we're looking for here. It's a physician that treated the patient. It's a physician that's board certified in a number of specialties. It's a physician that has not spent more than 25% of his time doing consulting activities. And the list goes on. It's laid out in 230791Z. Z1, Z2, Z3, A, B, and
well,
C,
counsel,
and Z4.
Well, counsel, to get to your question you want to talk about today, then let me make sure I understand. Sinnott, am I saying that right? Is it the 8th District case?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that's right.
Never came to this court, correct?
Sinnott,
it's an 8th District case.
Yes, they tried to get to this court. This court did not accept jurisdiction on that case.
And Sinnott stands for the proposition in Cuyahoga County that a veteran may use his medical records as that prong of the prima facie case. Correct?
Yes, I believe Sinnott interpreted competent medical authority to mean that in a particular case where, because of the circumstances of his treatment, in Sinnott it was a veteran, in Wipke it was an individual that used his union benefits, I believe, and in another case called David Hoover versus Norfolk Southern Railway, it was a case where the individual didn't have a doctor with the required board certification.
Right. Well, I guess that's what I'm trying to use your time properly, because the question before us today is what I'm using is the veteran's exception. Correct?
Yes.
And that is being followed in Cuyahoga County.
Yes.
Is it being followed anywhere else?
The only place I believe this has ever come up is in Cuyahoga County, because as Justice O'Donnell said, that's where the asbestos cases are. So it has come up in Cuyahoga County in more cases than just Sinnott. In fact, the 8th District, in fact, four different panels of that court have ruled that Sinnott is a proper interpretation of competent medical
authority.
It seems
to me you're facing a challenge in this case as well that Dr. Rao did not use, as the Court of Appeals said, magic words. Is that a problem?
I don't believe it is a problem, Your Honor. I don't believe it's a problem under the common law of Ohio, and I don't believe it's a problem under the Federal Employers Liability Act. Let me start with the common law of Ohio. And this court said in the Atkinson case that the common law of Ohio as to causation has not been changed by the passage of the asbestos bill. That's because this court interpreted it to be procedural only and not affecting anyone's substantive rights. So causation, of course, is substantive. So this court said that the common law had not been changed. The common law here in Ohio, under that common law, it would have been acceptable for Dr. Rao to say exactly what he said in his report. I cite some cases in my brief. I believe it's the Dingins case from the 10th Circuit. There's another case from the 11th Circuit and the Norris case from the 9th Circuit. In those cases, the doctor testified that asbestos played some role in one of them. In another one, the doctor testified that asbestos contributed. All of those opinions were found sufficient by those appellate courts. So they should still be sufficient now, according to this court's ruling in Atkinson. But I want to talk about the FELA a minute. Because under the FELA, the plain language of the FELA provides that the railroad cause must be a cause in whole or in part of the plaintiff's disease. So Dr. Rao's opinion that asbestos was a cause in part of his disease is certainly sufficient under the FELA. In fact, the substantial contributing factor language of the Ohio asbestos legislation should not be applied to FELA cases in any event. The Supreme Court of the United States decided a couple years ago a case called McBride versus CSX. In McBride versus CSX, Justice Ginsburg, writing for the court, was clear that the standard of causation in an FELA case is that the railroad cause must play any part in causing that disease. So it's not required that the FELA plaintiff prove substantial contributing factor. The FELA plaintiff at trial must prove that it's a cause in part. So that is one way that this statute clearly should not come under the FELA. And this court has—
Counsel, could I just ask you, you started to detail your discussions or your attempts to have Dr. Lynch to testify. Did you finish with that and come to the conclusion that he can't testify for whatever reason?
I'm glad you brought me back to that point, Your Honor, because
I was waiting until you got back there.
Because I wasn't finished with it. We spoke to Office of Regional Counsel in Indianapolis. She told me, she wrote me a letter that under the TUI regulations, which interpret 38 CFR 14808, I believe, that statute says that, that regulation says that VA officials shall not provide with or without compensation any expert opinion testimony in any private lawsuit. It's very clear, that section of the CFR, that you can't talk to our doctors. Our doctors are busy taking care of our veterans, taking care of our patients, and we don't want them to be involved in your legal proceedings. So I talked to her again after that, and she wrote me another letter that said, here's the factors. They're laid out in 14804, I believe. And the factors are many, whether or not, and you can read them in my brief.
Did you subpoena Dr. Lynch?
We did not subpoena Dr. Lynch, Your Honor, because the federal official is outside the subpoena power of the state of Ohio. And I think that's pretty well settled. I don't think that's even been argued that we should have subpoenaed. What has been argued is we should have appealed to the Office of General Counsel.
Could you elaborate on that? I'm unfamiliar with that.
Yeah,
are you saying you may not issue a subpoena in an Ohio court for a federal official?
What I'm saying, Your Honor, is under Toohey versus Reagan, which is a Supreme Court case from back in the 70s, a state official need not comply, I'm sorry, a federal official need not comply with a subpoena from a state court. And that's what that case stands for, and that's what the Office of Regional Counsel essentially told
me. The doctor at the VA is a federal official?
The VA doctor is a federal employee, and he is not subject to subpoena by the state court here in Ohio.
How did you find Dr. Rao?
Dr. Rao is an expert physician who reviewed the case, reviewed the medical records, reviewed the exposure testimony, reviewed the x-ray, and determined that the x-ray demonstrated asbestosis and his exposure history was consistent with exposure to asbestos. And upon his review, he determined that asbestos was a cause.
And that simply doesn't meet the statutory requirement of 230791 that the medical physician is actually a treating or has treated the individual.
That's the argument.
That's where we come now to this veteran exception rule.
That is the argument, Your Honor.
But
yes.
Is he also an expert witness that spends more than 25% of his time testifying?
He does not meet the requirements of competent medical authority as they're laid out in 230791.
Okay, in any respect?
Some of them. He may certainly meet some of them. He's got the required board certifications.
So he is a board-certified internist,
et cetera. Exactly.
He's actually treating or has treated the exposed person? No. As a basis of the diagnosis, the medical doctor has not relied in whole and part on any of the following. Well, that's the A and B exceptions. But you jump down to, I think, the fourth part of that statute. The medical doctor spends not more than 25% of this medical professional practice in providing consulting or expert services. He does more than 25%, correct?
I'm not sure about that, Your Honor. There's no evidence on that, and I've never asked him, so I'm not sure on that particular point. But in any case, the 8th District precedent, including the Hoover case, which I talked about a minute ago, allows the court to look at all the information in total. It allows it to look at the report of Dr. Rao, the exposure testimony of Darryl Rockenbaugh, the coworker, the medical records from the VA. And I want to note two things real quick. In the medical records from the VA, there was a note that said he worked on the railroad, he was exposed to coal dust, and he was exposed to brake shoe dust, which also contains asbestos, although that's not in the record. And the affidavit of Mr. Rockenbaugh, who testified by affidavit that he worked extensively around asbestos for over 20 years, that the asbestos dust they came in contact with was worn, dusty, frayed, and in basically in poor condition, and they breathed that dust in all the time. That was his testimony. So the 8th District precedent in these five cases that we're talking about, not just Sinnott, the other cases that have interpreted it, said that you can look at all that information together to see whether or not you can determine the competent medical authority requirements. So that's what they did in this case. They looked at those and they determined that the judge in Cuyahoga County, Judge Hanna, determined that he met those requirements. Can I go back for a minute to the VA, because I wasn't done discussing the Office of General Counsel. So I also called up the Office of General Counsel in Washington, D.C., and the Office of General Counsel said that under 14807, the official that makes the final determination is the Office of Regional Counsel. So there was no real answer on what the proper procedure is, what Mrs. Renfro should have done at that point. The fact is, that argument is raised for the first time in this court. That was never raised in the trial court. It was never raised in the 8th District that, well, perhaps Mrs. Renfro should have done something different at that particular time.
So basically, the representation is under Toohey versus Reagan, et cetera, no veterans doctor ever testifies in an asbestos case in Cuyahoga County.
That's exactly right, Your Honor, and that's what Office of Regional Counsel told us. So Amici has come up with a unique suggestion that they've suggested that we should have filed a lawsuit under the Administrative Procedures Act. They suggested that Mrs. Renfro should have went out, got another lawyer, filed another lawsuit in another state in federal court under the Administrative Procedures Act, and pursued it that way. And perhaps she would have won at the district court, or perhaps she would have lost. If she lost, she could appeal to the circuit court. If she lost there, she could appeal all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States just for the right to speak to her own treating doctors. So I can't believe that that's the General Assembly's intent in passing the legislation. How far would Mrs. Renfro have to go down this path that Amicus has marked before we can say that her substantive rights under the Ohio Constitution?
Well, if this legislation is flawed by having these requirements with regards to patients who are being treated at the Veterans Administration, why is this not something that simply can be remedied in the legislature?
Your Honor, I believe you wrote a concurrence in the Boley case a few years ago. It's another asbestos case. And you said that we as judges are not to impose our view as to the best policy to address asbestos claims. Mm-hmm. And that remains true today. It remains true until those asbestos claims start trampling on the substantive rights of individuals like Mrs. Renfro. When that happens, it's this court's role to stand up and say, you can't do that. You can't lock her out of the court. You can't close the courthouse doors on Mrs. Renfro. And under the FELA, you can't impair her substantive rights. And I'm almost out of time, but I need to talk about the Bogle case. In Bogle.
Actually, you are out of time.
I had one question, though, if I might. The statement by Dr. Rao, where he states that it was his opinion within a reasonable degree of medical certainty that the asbestos exposure in part contributed to the development of lung cancer. That doesn't seem to be exactly the substantial contribution that is required under the statute, is it?
Your Honor.
You say in part contribute, and you talk about that being substantial contribution.
In part contribute would be acceptable under the common laws existed before the statute was passed here in Ohio. It would also be acceptable under the FELA.
Can you cite a case that we have said that?
I can cite several appellate court cases.
Any that we have used.
I don't believe this court has said that particular thing. This court did decide a case called Murphy versus Carrollton Manufacturing, which I've cited in my brief. And in that case, this court recognized the fact of dual causation, that it said, you said, that where more than one factor is combined to produce a result, both of those factors are proximate cause. So something that partly caused something can be a proximate cause where two factors combine to cause a disease in that case.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Putheiser, you've used all your time. You can have 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to remind the court that when Mr. Torcello talks about violations of substantive rights, and Bogle, the Supreme Court here, said that the Ohio statute did not violate a fetal plaintiff's substantive rights. So that issue has been decided. I don't think it's an unfair stretch to say that probably plaintiff's counsel doesn't agree with the Bogle decision, but nonetheless, it is the law of this state. And as we've alluded to several times, it is up to the legislature to correct any perceived unfairnesses in the statute.
If we agree with your position, is Mrs. Renfro precluded from pursuing this claim?
Well, the case would be administratively dismissed. And I know the
administrative dismissal simply means that there isn't an affidavit or there isn't some evidence to get the complaint up to permit the court to hear it. But as Mr. Torcello argues to us, she can never get that because of the preclusions allegedly interposed from counsel at the federal level and the preclusion of medical testimony being made available.
Realistically, I think that's probably a fair argument that she would be out of court.
Well, counsel, what do you do about the fact that no VA doctor can testify in a state court about the causal relationship for the death of a alleged asbestos-related cancer?
Well, number one, I don't necessarily accept the premise that in all cases a VA doctor couldn't provide evidence in this case. But once again, I would say that that is a situation for the legislature to remedy and not the courts.
Well, not necessarily. Now, if there is a blanket exception, according to your opposing counsel, that VA doctors do not come into state court and support the efforts of the decedent or the plaintiff, let's say, is that not a denial of their ability for redress?
I would argue no, Your Honor. There's a couple of points on that I'd like to amplify. You could maybe create a lesser rule where there is some actual medical evidence of asbestos exposure. Now, a good example of this, even though I disagree with the holding, was Sinnott. Sinnott, the record was littered with references to occupational asbestos exposure in the medical records. There is nothing in this case that argues that. Now, you can make an argument, okay.
So, wait a minute, you're saying under those circumstances, the VA doctor, the treating doctor who's created those medical records can't come in and testify, but the keeper of the records can get those records in to the court?
I'm not saying I would find that acceptable, Your Honor, but—
Pardon me?
I'm not saying I would necessarily find that acceptable, Your Honor, but as a way to cure a perceived unfairness, you could at least say in Sinnott, well, look, there was a lot of medical record evidence of asbestos exposure.
But who's going to interpret those records? I mean, if that was the situation where all you needed was dump a banker box full of records on the court and say, look through it, court, and figure out where there's support for the position without having a physician on the stand that, you know, can interpret and apply the information.
Yeah, I can understand your point, Your Honor, in that there is at least a question of fairness there. However, that's the statute, regardless, still requires a competent medical authority.
But if the statute makes it impossible for any plaintiff who has been treated by the Veterans Administration to bring forth a physician that will meet the statutory requirements, then they are denied the ability to address the court, are they not?
As the way the statute is written, probably yes. However,
couldn't we take that into consideration here?
I would say you can't, Your Honor, because of the well-established rules of statutory construction, which says that you can't rewrite the statute.
You can't what?
Rewrite the statute.
But we can declare it unconstitutional if it's denying a plaintiff's redress to open courts.
You could, as was pointed out before, though, this issue was never raised before either the Ohio constitutional issues were never raised before the trial court. They were never raised before the Court of Appeals.
Would there be anything to stop us from asking for briefing on that and have a follow-up oral argument?
Obviously, the court can do that if the court wants to have additional briefing on this issue. But our position is that, for number one, the issues were not raised below. They're not ripe for consideration here. They were never addressed before the 8th District. And this court has said, in the case that I have in mind here, is Ohio Civil Service Employees versus State Employment Relations Board. It's 104 Ohio State 3rd, 122 at paragraph 10, that the court generally does not consider issues that the Court of Appeals did not reach. And these issues were not reached by the Court of Appeals, especially the access to courts. The primary reason they were not reached is because he didn't raise them.
And he didn't have to because the cases were in line with his position, correct? I mean, Sinnott and Wipke were all saying the exception exists, so there's no reason to get into the constitutional issues.
Right, but at the same time, they didn't have to reach them. That doesn't mean this court has to reach them.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision. Thank you.
Thank you.